Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Klatch. This is Marianne Russo. I want to say hello to my co-moderators, Chuck Wally and Mae Wilkinson. The chat room will be open on Twitter if anybody would like to interact. I'm very excited tonight to have Sharon Davenport. Sharon is the Executive Director of the Autism Women's Network and the host of Autism Women Network Radio. She is a mom to four children, of whom one has Asperger's syndrome, and you know she is a tireless advocate for women and children, particularly those whose lives have been touched by domestic violence. And she knows of what she speaks, as she herself is an adult living with Asperger's. So I'm thrilled. Sharon, welcome to the Coffee Klatch.
Thank you, Marian. It's nice to be here.
You know, Sharon, when I was going over your bio, I was struck by the fact that you were not diagnosed until you were an adult. How old were you, and how difficult was it for you to function as a child not being diagnosed?
Well, I was actually about 42 when I received my diagnosis. Although I had already had a few assessments done more than, I guess it was about a year prior, as well as having sought a second opinion after having the first assessment, I was quite convinced that I wasn't on the spectrum, and it wasn't that I don't mean that in a negative way, it was just that I never really equated Asperger's in myself because I compared everything to how my son presented. And I had remembered the challenges I had as a child, and they didn't always seem to follow the same pattern as my son. So comparing it that way, I really wasn't looking outside the box. I wasn't, taking into consideration I was a female and an adult at this point. So definitely it was something that I was probably pretty surprised to have it even brought to my attention, to have the assessment, but nonetheless was very, very happy that I did. As far as my childhood, academically, it was, I did pretty good in school, so there wasn't really academically many challenges other than my mother having some huge concerns and within the social arena. I was really socially challenged as a child and through my teen years, and even as an adult, it's something that I really have to still work on, those social challenges.
You know, you hear that a lot, that, you know, really for some children, because, you know, it's such a vast spectrum that, you know, for some children, they don't have a lot of the presentations that other children have, and the social deficits really are what's most predominant, most, you know, troublesome. And, you know, you were diagnosed after your son. So, you know, looking back, what were some of the red flags that, you know, you think they missed through your childhood?
Well, I really don't think my mother missed any of them, to be quite honest. I believe that, of course, I was being raised in a time where Asperger's wasn't even an available diagnosis. You know, like, what was it, 1993, I believe, or something like that. Yeah, and so, you know, I was raised long before that, my childhood, and my mother, she really tried. She advocated within the family, within the school system when she saw that I was struggling socially. I really had a lot of, I would have classified it as severe awkwardness, but it really went beyond that. That's putting it nicely. My mother always saw it. She knew that I had extreme focuses and that I was pretty much a loner. I didn't really socialize. I didn't even see the need in it. And I believe that my mother saw this. She was raising four children, and she saw this as being very different. And she didn't understand that I was happy. First of all, I can tell her that now, you know, I was happy. I tell her there's, you know, it wasn't really anything that she needed to worry about. But being a parent that, you know, you're raising four children and you see your other children presenting one way, I think she really focused on the differences. And it, like I said, I don't think she really missed anything. And specifically some of the things I think she knew that I took some things to extreme. My father always liked to call it naivete. My mother really understood, though, that there were some things I just really wasn't understanding and getting. I would take it the wrong way, or my father just thought I was very naive, and my mother knew that it was much more than that, to the point that she worried about my safety, that I would trust the wrong people, or, you know, as a mother, she just kind of sensed the overall impact that it was really having
right.
on me. And other people looking from the outside in, whether it was an educator or a friend or maybe one of my mother's friends, they only saw like one instance or a couple instances. My mother saw the whole picture. So from her aspect, she really didn't miss anything. Everything, my mother says that everything makes complete sense to her. You know, the diagnosis,
right.
everything makes complete sense to her.
Yeah, you know, back then I think they used to, term that the child was painfully shy, you know, and,
yes.
you know, really didn't catch that there were just so many social deficits. And, you know, it's so anxiety driven. There's so much fear. And I think, you know, it's true for first time parents. They may not realize the, the deficits in the social area. But, you know, if you have a few kids before, it really is pretty, pretty obvious. You have a son that's on the spectrum. And, I know that you have the Autism Women Network. So, you know, I wanted to go into a bit about the differences of presentation. So what differences do you see between, you know, girls versus boys on the spectrum? Because, you know, I would assume that it's pretty, pretty different.
It really is, Marianne. And I would probably say that the intense focus that girls and women, especially children, the intense focus that they develop, girls tend to have a different kind of focus, interest. And I've heard it dubbed in different ways, and this isn't meant to be an insult or anything when I say this, but the word bizarre seems to come up. They'll say, well, boys tend to have a little bit more bizarre, obsessions or focused interests. And like I said, I don't want people getting upset and thinking I mean bizarre in a bad way. I think that they just use that word in the articles that I've read, just trying to make that contrast stand out more, that a girl might spend hours and hours and hours with an intense focus interest in, you know, horses or, you know, Marie Antoinette, you know, some kind of historical figure, and a boy might, you know, collect bottle caps or do something different, you know, and so the focus interest is very different, and I think that that's where sometimes girls can fly under the radar. Maybe not look at so much what the person is focusing on and what they're really spending on this. Is it something that is really that intense? Hello?
Sharon, are you on the air?
I am. I'm here. I don't know what happened. I'm very sorry. Did I disconnect?
I have no idea. This has never happened. It was almost like an air raid. Okay. We'll just have to edit. the two of us. I mean, this is what we do, blog talk, and we're both like, what's going on here? I apologize, audience. We will edit all of that out. When we left off, we were discussing the differences between girls and boys on the spectrum. So
okay.
I hope you can...
You know, I don't even know where I left off. I don't know where I was going off. I don't want to
start all over again.
I'm sorry, Marianne. I think I was just basically talking about the focus interest. They tend to be different in females and girls and boys. They just tend to be so different. Boys might have a more different kind of focus and something that might catch someone's attention because of the nature of their interest, whereas a girl might be more streamlined. She's interested in something that maybe wouldn't stand out as being something that would concern someone. And I don't mean that in a bad way, like, oh, you know, it's so concerning that a boy has a certain interest. But I just mean that it's not going to have as, it's not going to draw as much attention, maybe.
Right. And, you know, I think that, you know, oftentimes the girls more have the anxiety and the, you know, are more withdrawn, you know, where sometimes boys present more with more ADHD features, you know. You know, but I would mention that once they get into the teen years, it must really, because, you know, that's really when it becomes very apparent, especially if it hasn't been caught early. So, you know, what would be some of the more difficult challenges for teen girls on the spectrum? Because, I mean, being a teen girl, you know, when you don't have Asperger's is a horror, so I can imagine how difficult it must be for these kids.
Right. I believe that... I'm not going to only speak for myself again because we're all different, but I know that there seems to be kind of a running theme that a lot of girls and women, we talk about this, and it seems to be, we find some similarities in what I'm about to describe. And one of those is that in your teen years, I think that girls are held to higher expectations, number one, from our peers, and maybe even social expectations from our family and schools. You know, girls must, you know, act ladylike and act a certain way. So we learn at a very young age to conform. And then when you get into your teen years and adolescence, like you said, so hard anyway, whether you're on the spectrum or not. And then if you're very naive, if you want to use the word naive, or you're taking language literally, whatever your challenge might be, those things are really going to start coming out in social situations where you are going to start standing out a little bit more as a little bit different. So that can be just devastating to some girls. They can feel like they're really standing out to an extent that other people are looking at them and wondering, you know, wow, she didn't get that, or wow, why does she think that way? So we step our game up a little bit. I know that I did. I learned to just kind of nod and smile a lot and just kind of, you know, sit at a table with a whole group of people. When I saw them laughing, even if I didn't get why they were, I would laugh too, Mary, and I would just go right along with it. So you learn to get through these social situations, but at the same time, it's also proving to be a huge disservice because you're wanting to tell anyone that you don't understand, so you're not really learning what's going on, and you're setting yourself up for so many different things.
Yeah, you know, and it's almost like a double-edged sword. I mean, I see it here, you know, when I see teens that, you know, I obviously can tell, you know, that they have, you know, something going on usually somewhere on the spectrum. And, you know, I think it's almost
right.
A double-edged sword because, you know, I think that not everyone is very open about their diagnosis. I think that children, you know, the teens sometimes themselves aren't aware of, you know, their diagnosis. And, you know, the sensory issues come into play, too, I think, for the girls, because they'll go to a movie or, you know, these teenage girls, they have the music blasting and they're dancing and they're screaming. And, you know, it's very hard
mm-hmm.
for, you know, I can see it,
oh, yeah.
You know, that it's so uncomfortable. You know, you mentioned before that, you know, there is higher expectations. Did you mean among their girlfriends and things like that? Well, you know, what did, could you just elaborate on that a
I
little
think
bit?
So. Well, this is my own personal experience, and from talking to, you know, other girls and women, I believe that most people can agree that, you know, girls, we, you know, females, we tend to be, girls tend to be harder on our peers, don't you think? I mean, when I don't know. I mean, I've raised two boys and I've got two girls.
Absolutely.
And I come from a family of two boys and two girls. And just from my own personal situation throughout the 47 years I've been on this planet, I think I've kind of seen that girls, we can be really tough on one another. You know,
women can be brutal
on other women. And, you know, it kind of reminds me that I saw on your Facebook the other day, Mary, and you said there's a, I forgot who you quoted. Was Albright, I think it was, or Albright, you said that there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. Well, there's a reason why
Absolutely.
She probably came up with that saying. You know, I mean, we really can be brutal. Like, what about that movie, that Mean Girls it's called, I think? I mean,
right.
you think about it.
Right.
I'm not putting women down. I'm just saying that we do tend to have higher expectations of one another. And I think that society itself, you know, we kind of excuse different behaviors and say, oh, boys will be boys, you know, they're going to kind of roll in the mud and kind of play and do this and do that. And so when different behaviors come out in boys, I think it's more readily obvious. Whereas if
right.
a girl, you know, is held to higher expectations, we tend to
conform,
and even if we don't know why.
And I think they deal with conflict differently. I mean, you know, the boys can have a slugfest and, you know, to beat the hell out of each other. And the next day, you know, they're playing catch. Where the girls, you know, if they have a conflict, they have to make sure that every girl that they know knows that they're right and get them on their side. It's just, it's brutal. I mean, I've always told my kids, if you can make it through middle school, you can make it through anything. Because, you know, it's really just such a difficult time.
Right?
And for the, you know, and for you,
you
know,
know
as we're saying, you're very literal, so it must be difficult,
right.
You know, for these girls to understand sarcasm, I would think too.
Well, you know, that's a good point, Marian, because that's something that I know personally I have struggled with. Even though on one hand, like we were talking a few minutes ago about it being kind of a double-edged sword, one way it's a good thing, and then on the other hand, well, it maybe not be so good. I see that happening with myself constantly throughout my life, and I've even seen this with you know, not just girls or women, but boys too on the spectrum, where you may not even get when somebody is saying something bad about us or picking on us. I mean, I'm almost 47 years old, and I've had people have to tell me, well, no, so-and-so has said something, and this is really, maybe you might want to consider what they're saying because this isn't really good. And I'm like, I can be very, I don't know, gullible, innocent about it. I had no idea that that's what that person meant. And then I tend to take it even further, Mary, and then I'm like, well, okay, if that's what they meant, and they obviously don't understand the situation. So then I tend to be very forgiving and don't realize, ooh, maybe that person's still not so, you know, I tend to give people maybe even the benefit of a doubt. I don't get all the signs and flags that maybe they're just, it's not a great situation to surround myself with or to be involved in. And even as an adult, I still struggle with that and don't always get something that I need to be wary of.
And, you know, I would assume that really, you know, lends itself to be a problem when, you know, boys and dating come into the picture because, you know, as you said, you know, there's a naivety to it and there's, you know, miscommunication. So, you know, how are dating and relationships impacted, you know, if at all, by the disorder?
Well, you know, with any kind of neural difference, I think it's going to have some kind of impact depending on how it presents in you. I know myself personally, I can remember at a very young age, and then it has followed me throughout my life, learning to conform was a huge part, just practicing, watching other people, watching other girls. Watching people in relationships, reading books about relationships and dating, and thinking that I had to learn how to be what these books or movies or, and I don't mean like Hollywood movies, I'm talking about even documentaries, just something about relationships that I always tried to, I researched everything, I was very analytical about everything, and especially before knowing that I was, you know, on the spectrum, it was a huge disservice because I was very black and white. I thought, no, it has to be this way or it's not right, you know. And so
yeah.
I think that it can be really challenging. I think it's been very empowering since learning about my diagnosis and learning how I process information, I can take a step back and learn what didn't work for me, learn why it didn't work for me, and then understand how I'm processing language information from other people. And I think it has helped with relationships in general a lot.
You know, what would you say to parents that have, you know, a teen girl about explaining, you know, their sexuality to them and, you know, dating and, you know, setting limits? You know, how could you help a parent out in that area?
I believe, first of all, that to realize that your spectrumite daughter is okay with you being probably being very blunt and literal, not to hold back, but to be very honest. I think that we can do our any child, boy or girl, but we're talking about females here. You know, we need to understand that the vulnerableness with any young girl, and then of course you add any kind of challenge on whatever that may be, and you're going to have it magnified somewhat. So just to trust that. Being very direct with your daughter, not being scared to talk about the tough subjects, you know, and the tough topics mm-hmm. when it comes to sex, relationship. To be very open and honest, because it is going to, in the long run, serve her well. And she's not going to have to wonder or experiment or ask the wrong person and get the wrong answer. You know, I've right. seen that happen so many times. There have been a few situations throughout the years I found myself in because I sought information in the wrong place and asked the wrong person. It could be very dangerous, too.
You know, today they really do a very good job with sex education in school. But, you know, there's nothing like... you know, having your older child, I'm not talking about a young teen, but, you know, an older daughter, you know,
right.
being able to come to you to discuss it. You know, it's really, it's important whether they're on the spectrum or not. You know, as I mentioned earlier when I introduced you, you're passionate about domestic violence. Is domestic violence more prevalent right. in homes with Asperger's? Is that why you focused on this?
No, that's not why I focus on it. Personally, I have known people in my life that have been impacted quite dramatically by domestic violence. So it became a personal passion on a personal level because of personal situations that I have seen others in. And so because of that, it did become something that was very, very important to me to understand. I don't know the exact statistics, but personally, if I had to even make an estimate or a guess, I would say that no, I don't think that domestic violence is more prevalent. You can equate that with Asperger's in any way. In fact, I think that it's probably really important that people understand that understanding domestic violence will help people understand the difference between what they might be seeing as behavioral challenges in someone on the spectrum or families that are impacted by it, as opposed to the true psychopathy and mentality of domestic violence. Completely different, you know. The psychopathy
right.
and of domestic violence and the demeaning of another person and believing that someone is less of a human than you are is completely different than behaviors you're going to see maybe in a meltdown or something like that. So.
Yeah, because, you know, I was surprised when I read that. That's why I wanted to ask you, because I was surprised when I read that, and I didn't think that it was correlated with Asperger's, so I did want to let you clarify that.
Right.
And I think that a lot of people, you know, they just don't understand, you know, why women stay, you know, and why they don't just get out. So
right.
Maybe you can shed a little bit
right.
of light on that so that someone, if they have a friend in that position, they could help them.
Right. And I do want to say that I do believe that, you know, women and girls, even men on the spectrum, boys and men, and, you know, I don't want to leave them out when it comes to this, but there is a certain kind of vulnerability, too, of anyone on the spectrum when it comes to finding ourselves in situations where we might not see all those signs of someone that might have that kind of psychopathy and that kind of mentality of that, you know, domestic violence and an abuser or, you know, and a batterer. We may not see that, and whereas somebody else, they might see those red flags. It there, again, it goes back to maybe how we process information. So we can find ourselves maybe involved in a situation because of that vulnerability. But I think that anyone, I've known a lot of neurotypicals that are in these situations and had no clue until they were in the middle of it and didn't know how to get out. So, you know, it touches everyone, whether you're on the spectrum or not, but there is a definite vulnerability that we have to be able to acknowledge, those of us on the spectrum. It's not saying that we're weak. I don't believe that me as a female on the spectrum to stand up and say, I recognize what my vulnerabilities are and I'm okay with that. And now that empowers me to do something positive about it and to say, I will surround myself with people that I can trust that will help me see, you know, maybe different signs that maybe I don't naturally see as readily as someone else. And that empowers me to make those decisions that will be healthy for me and my children.
Well, that's beautifully said. Before we jump ahead, we're going to start going into a little bit about, women on the spectrum. But I did want to just go back to one thing. Do you find an endocrine connection at all in the girl teens? Because I found that in my situation, and I have Dr. Valerie Hu coming on in a few weeks, and she's researching autism down at George Washington, and they're finding a lot of endocrine issues. Is that, do you find that a lot of the girls on the spectrum have hormonal imbalances as well that need to be checked out?
You know, from personal experience, you know, I'm just going to love to listen to the show that you're having with Valerie because I would like to know the research aspect of it. She would be actually the person you definitely would want to get the accurate information from. As a layperson, just speaking in general, I would say that I probably have not met a girl or a woman on the spectrum that has not expressed some kind of hormonal challenge. Now, I'm sure now that I've said this on the radio, I'm going to be contacted by a lot of people who might say, well, they don't. But I'm just saying, in general, if I had to make a blanket statement, I would have to say that definitely I can see that there does tend to be some kind of pattern there.
It's important, for people like you and I to mention it because I think it's missed.
Right.
I think it's missed a lot. And I think that a lot of girls, teen girls, that do have these endocrine problems and hormonal, issues can really be helped a lot if it's identified. So, that was just something I just wanted to throw out there. I want to move on a little bit because despite what some people think, people do not grow out of autism. They basically learn coping skills and tools to succeed. So what issues do women on the spectrum face in the workplace and, in the social arena?
First of all, I could start with the workplace because that's been something that I definitely have had some challenges in. I have always, for the past several years, held positions, managerial and supervisory positions, and I think back several years ago to a position that I held. I was a supervisor, and I can remember the first review that I got after I was working for this company. I did my job, was there on time, never got written up for doing anything really wrong. But what they were really concerned about, what my immediate supervisor was very concerned about, is that I didn't socialize enough. They thought that maybe I was not fitting into the company because I wasn't going and socializing in other people's offices, I was floored. I was like, seriously? I mean, at first I thought she was joking, and I kind of paused for a moment, and I realized she was serious, and I'm like, are you serious? You really are serious, right? And she's like, yes, you even take lunch in your office. You don't even take lunch in the break room, and I'm like, okay. So I began to realize, definitely well into adulthood, this was just a few years ago, and this was even after my diagnosis, I began to realize that socializing is a huge thing for females or women and girls, and not, I guess it's just a huge thing. And it's something that I have had to try to understand, Marian, on a level that I never really allowed myself to understand before. I was more or less like, I convinced myself, well, that just doesn't apply to me, so I'm not even going to worry about it. But really, it does apply to me. I mean, if I'm going to be out there, you know, in this world and in the workforce and you know, trying to find my way as a single parent, providing for my children, I do need to understand these things. And I began to realize that that was a huge thing. And I started looking back on my path throughout life when it came to work. And I realized that probably was my number one challenge, was dealing with other people. I could go and sit at my desk and work 10, 12 hours a day, get my work done, and not speak to another person and be completely happy. But I did not fit into that office, and I would not, it just didn't seem to work, even though I did my job.
I was going to say, John Robison wrote in the book that, you know, he didn't, when he was working in an office situation, he didn't get the small talk. You know, he didn't understand why somebody was telling him that someone was having an affair. You know, it just didn't make any sense.
That's right,
to him.
Yeah.
And, you know, it didn't interest him. Like, you know,
right.
You know, his reaction was, am I supposed to do something, you know, with this information? So,
right.
You know, what do you think, what is the difficulty that adults have? Is it a lack of desire or interest, or is it a social anxiety?
I think it's different for everyone. I really do. And I think that that's what we need to have better job assessments for people that do have neuro differences. I think that that's really important to take these things seriously, because I think you can't just make a blanket statement and go with it. But I do think in order to answer your question in this kind of arena for the radio show, I think that what we can say safely is that definitely it goes back to kind of – I can only speak for myself again. It's that mindset of, I'm here to do my job. I don't want to know who is sleeping with who, or, you know, I mean, I don't mean to sound crass, but kind of like, you know, what Don said about having an affair, you know, he didn't want to know about that. It just didn't make sense to me. That whole social aspect of the office atmosphere, it was completely foreign to me, Marion, in every single way. And
right.
It really offended my coworkers, completely offended them. And it wasn't about them. It was just about my comfort level. You know, I was uncomfortable discussing other people's business. I didn't feel it was my place. I didn't feel it was my place to discuss other people's lives. Didn't feel comfortable with it at all.
And I think, you know, constructing a niche. Have you had Dr. Thomas Armstrong on your show yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, he wrote Neurodiversity, fantastic, fantastic book. And it's about all different...
Yes, I follow him on Twitter.
He's great, and the book is spectacular. But the one thing that the book says is constructing a niche, you know, be it educational, be it in your career, be it in your relationship, that suits, you know, your disorder. And, you know, I think in a situation like this, you know, that's why different people don't... particularly like you're saying, you know, being in an office where there's a lot of gossip and there's expected, you know, interacting can be very difficult for somebody on the spectrum, you know. So
right.
You know, constructing the niche there is important too. But, well, you certainly overcome, because you have created the Autism Women's Network, which is incredible. So, you know, tell us how you started it and what it's all about.
Well, I definitely cannot take I cannot take credit for the AWN personally and solely. First, I'd like to say that, because, truth be known, AWN was founded in a rather spur of the moment kind of way, and I don't mean just like overnight kind of spur of the moment, but it was kind of taken from a lot of different experiences that many of the founding directors who are still on today. Of course, we've only been online just a little over a year. And a lot of us got together after having experienced a whole range of different kinds of, some negative, some positive, but very different experiences in other organizations, and specifically just within the autism community. And we wanted to be a part of an organization that was more inclusive, and more inclusive in a way of not just saying it's for Asperger's, but saying it's for the spectrum, whether it's PDD, NOS, Cantor's autism, Asperger's, you know, whatever ASD, we wanted to be more inclusive in that way. We wanted to be more gender inclusive, and that's something that our board is really working on right now. We have a couple people on our board who are very they're very in tune with the needs of that population and gender differences. And so they're really educating me a lot as to that. And so we're hoping that the AWN will be able to just be more inclusive with a broad range of different things. So it was kind of founded on the concept of just trying to be an organization that's more inclusive, not political. People have asked me, they assume that we're a political organization because we have the word advocacy in it, but AWN is not political at all.
Right.
We don't have any political desire or aspirations at all. The word advocacy is truly a kind of a personal resource kind of advocacy thing that we would provide.
And, you know, you were mentioning your co-founders and your board. I mean, you have incredible people. You know, if anyone goes to the website and just, you know, takes a look, you will just be so impressed. You know, and the Coffee Clutch pretty much started on the same, you know, same way. It was a whim. You know, we started this to just offer parents a place to go in the morning and chat and help each other out. And, you know, who knew?
Right.
You know, and it just...
That's right. That's kind of what it was for us. We just wanted to start a forum, just an online forum where we could, you know, have a kind of an online community where it was inclusive of all different kinds of experiences, because really the autism experience is a very unique experience. No two families or no two individuals are going to have the same experience, and we wanted to provide an atmosphere and a place where it can be inclusive and be accepting of those
right.
differences. And that's what really we're striving to do. I mean, we're brand new. We're just getting started at this. So we're by no means where we want to be. But I'm pretty happy with, you know, all the directors. And they've just worked so hard. And everyone has just completely poured their own passion and personal experiences into everything, every step along the way. And it's just, I feel very honored and privileged to be part of the AWN alongside with all the directors and coordinators.
Now, and you know what I like about it too is that you have women of all ages, and I think that, you know, with comorbidity,
right.
with so many different disorders, that, you know, it's not just autism, that, you know, there's no two children that are the same. You know, you find that with children with all types of disorders, and it's really important for parents to be able to talk to other parents, and it's important to, you know, women on the spectrum to speak with other women. I mean, you know, as you said
right.
before, as Madeleine Albright said, you know, women have to help women. So tell us about the resources and the support that you offer.
Well, first and foremost, we are trying to create a community on our forum to where it's an online community where we post different kinds of resources and information, different conversations are going on over there. That's our biggest support right now. We're trying to grow our radio show, AWN Radio, to where we have a variety of guests on, and we're just basically we're so new right now that what we would like to eventually offer is nothing compared to what, you know, we are right now. But right now, basically what we're doing is trying to offer a community, an online community and forum to where we could be a presence in the autism community to offer support to families, girls, women, or anyone who supports them and ASDs, and learn about the differences, because so many times we're finding more and more that girls and women are being diagnosed later in life, because what we talked about earlier is just so true, the way that we fly under the radar for so many years, it contributes to us ending up leading, you know, a life that we look back on and we think, ouch, sometimes we could have made different choices had we known something. And just learning to understand, you know, those subtle differences in the way females present who are on the spectrum can go a long way towards lending support to the younger girls on the spectrum.
Absolutely. It really is a terrific service that you're doing. You were recently invited to the White House, so tell us, you know, how that came to be and what your experience was there.
Well, it was for a meeting at the White House last year on World Autism Awareness Day. The White House had organized a special meeting that they were going to have with different organizations around the country to commemorate World Autism Awareness Day by bringing all the organizations together, talking about the different goals that the administration had for basically moving forward for supports in the autism community. And I received an invitation to be there to represent the Autism Women's Network. And it was quite an honor. It was a wonderful experience. I have a funny story behind it too, Marion. It was kind of funny that when I first received the invitation, I was first contacted by email. I thought it was a prank, and I felt so silly. I was like, right, okay, I got this invitation to the White House. So being the stickler that I am for rules and how dare somebody do this to me and play a terrible joke on me like this, you know, and I called the White House. And I was like, listen, I just think you should know that I got this, you know, fake invitation to the White House. And so they started laughing. And they're like, well, who's it from? And, okay, well, we'll put you through to Mr. Kringdale. So they put me through to the assistant to the president. I'm talking to him. I'm like, listen, Mr. Dale, I'm really sorry to tell you, but your name is being used. And he just busted out laughing, right? And he's like, oh, Sharon. He's like, you're killing me here. You're killing me. And I'm like, what? He's like, it's real, Sharon. You've been invited for the Autism Women's Network. We'd really like to have you there to represent the Autism Women's Network. I'm like, okay, then. I felt like, you know, so here I was calling to check this person out and see if this person actually really existed, and I ended up talking to him directly, and it was pretty funny. But,
That's a great story.
Back on that, and it's one to remember for sure. It was a little bit more touchy when I was in the moment. I was like, oh, my gosh, I couldn't believe that, you know, I had actually called. And I was a little bit embarrassed afterwards, but it didn't hit me for like 2 days, so I was not embarrassed in the moment. So I was pretty good to go.
Right. I mean, who would expect, you know, to be invited to the White House? I mean, that's fantastic. And you're also being acknowledged. This week you're coming here to New York, and you're getting an award from PBS, I believe you said.
No, it's actually through, it's a private school for children on the spectrum there in New York, and it's their annual benefit, and they have actually said that they were going to recognize 4 people in the autism community, or 4 people who have contributed some way to the autism community, and Charlie Rose of PBS is one of the people being recognized, along with Fred Volkmer, Dr. Fred Volkmer of Yale. The mm-hmm. Yale Child Study Center, and then Mrs. Janice Murray, the mother from the Showtime documentary Dads in Heaven with Nixon. She's getting the parent recognition, and then they've asked me to attend for AWN. So
well, that's some incredible company you're going to be with.
Yes, it is. I said that I'm so excited to be able to actually meet Mrs. Murray. We were so privileged to have her and her son, Tom, who was the director of the documentary Dads in Heaven with Nixon, and her daughter, Helen. They were on AWN radio last year, and I'm the highlight of this trip will definitely be to meet Mrs. Murray. I'm just really looking forward to that.
Well, enjoy. You know, I wanted to just go into a few more things, and then we have... you know, just a little bit, 15 minutes left. If anybody would like to call in, we will be taking your call soon, 646-595-2881. That's 646-595-2881. I did want to discuss neurodiversity. I mean, it's a very hot topic these days. What do you think of neurodiversity and the idea that, you know, people on the spectrum should not need to conform their way of life, but to be accepted as people with differences, just like, you know, any other difference? How do you feel about that?
Right. The concept is wonderful. I mean, think about it. Wouldn't it be a perfect world if that were actually true, wouldn't it? I mean, I think about that, and I think about the concept of, you know, those words you just said, and I think, wow, if people could be accepted on equal footing, you know, no matter what their differences are, wouldn't that be fantastic? Wouldn't that be wonderful? And then, You know, but like anything else too, Mary, and I think that anything could be taken to an extreme, and I think that it's really important that those of us who are self-advocates and we're out there trying to help people understand what it is like to have these neurodifferences, I think, you know, there comes a responsibility that we have too to keep our those checks and balances in place to where we don't take anything to, like, you could take anything to an extreme. As long as I think that people are understanding and keeping it balanced, I think that the concept can actually be solid and just have, it can go beyond just being words, and it can actually be something that's solidified. But at the same time, you know, neurodiversity, I've heard, I don't know about you, Mary, but I've heard different people describe it in different ways to them. So sometimes
right.
even myself, as a self-advocate, I could be confused. I could hear one person say one thing and it may not mean the same thing to me. But I do know that basically what you said is what it means to me. It means to be accepted and to be able to be have equal footing in our communities, society, in life in general. And be accepted for all of our differences. You know, it just, it would be so nice to think that that could actually really happen. Getting there is,
well, you know,
is
honestly,
what
I don't see
separates.
How it cannot happen because with one out of every 110 children conservatively, you know, being diagnosed on the spectrum, you know, I think
mm-hmm.
that neurodiversity is going to be the future. You know, I think that the positives and the brilliance of people on the spectrum is going to become very apparent and you know, very much admired. That's what I hope, anyway.
You know, I really, me too, I really admire these young advocates because they have a lot of passion that I may feel inside of me, but I would never even know how to begin. I don't know if it's generational. I don't know. You know, it's not like I you know, I'm not trying to make myself sound like I'm prehistoric or anything, but, you know, I am from a generation where, you know, I've learned a lot from the younger advocates and self-advocates, and I know that they're, we need those young advocates to be able to have that passion and drive that forces change, and we do need a lot of change. I'm still pretty old school. I believe in good old manners, and so I'm always probably going to do things maybe a little bit different than the younger advocates, but I just am in awe of a lot of them, and I admire them, and I think that, like you said, I can't see it going any other way.
No, and you have Taylor Morris, who, you know, I've had on, I guess, 3 times already. She's just incredible.
Yes.
She's a young woman. I think she's probably 17 now, and, you know, what she's doing is just remarkable,
mm-hmm.
really just making teens on the spectrum, you know, just fit in and, you know, really just understood. She's
mm-hmm.
really been a voice for them, and, you know, it's very important.
Right.
I'd like to just end off with one other question, and that is, what would you tell a parent of a daughter on the spectrum about accepting the diagnosis and the differences that it will bring? So, you know, what would you tell a parent?
Wow, that's kind of open-ended. Let me think here. So what would I tell? Are you asking what I would tell a parent?
What advice? What
when they first receive a diagnosis? Or is that what you're asking? Like when they first receive a diagnosis, a child? Hello?
Hi, sorry, switchboard is crazy tonight.
Oh,
no, what I was asking was, I guess that's it. You know, what would you tell, I'm sorry,
okay.
What would you tell a parent,
okay.
You know, that has a daughter on the spectrum about accepting the diagnosis and, you know, accepting
okay.
the child for who she is?
Sure. Well, first of all, I've actually had this conversation and had parents, you know, reach out and ask me questions. So I've actually been able to have these kinds of conversations with parents. And I guess what I make it a practice to do initially is to encourage them to remember that before they receive the their child is still the same person as they were before they received that diagnosis. So try not to look at it as a label. Just try to embrace it as something that already was. Their child was already, you know, had that neural difference anyway. They just didn't have it officially brought to their attention. Trying to get them down to that kind of mindset. Sometimes that does help when they can concentrate on that. And then, you know, I do try to let them understand. I think it helps when I'm able to talk about the challenges, and some of them were quite severe when it came to sensory challenges and behaviors that I had when I was a child, because people will point out now, you know, oh, wow, you know, I've had some people who can meet me and think, oh, you don't know what it's like to be on the spectrum. You don't have any challenges. But they don't know, like we talked about earlier, about how far it comes to accommodate and how we learn to accommodate and we grow as people and we get older and mature. And so I try to encourage them to remember that their child is a child and they've got their whole life ahead of them, and to concentrate on the child's strengths and, you know, not just focus on challenges, because when you only focus on challenges, you tend to automatically bring a negative approach to anything anyway. So I just try to encourage them to think about their child's strengths, to embrace their gifts and their you know, the things that they honor about their child, and to really tap into those strengths and then watch their child flourish. I try to encourage that most of all.
You're my clone. that's what I've been telling parents too. I mean, you got to look beyond the disorder, beyond the diagnosis, and see
right.
that great kid. You know, there's a brilliance to everyone.
Right.
And, you know, these kids have gifts like everyone else has gifts. And, you know, you can't be looking at this child with blinders and negativity. You know, there's just you just have to foster the positives. So, you know, I just really,
right.
I'm so glad you came on. I really admire you. You know, Autism Women's Network is just incredible. What is the website so that people can jump over there?
Okay, it is autismwomensnetwork.org. And that's it. And get there, and then you can, it's pretty easy to navigate. Our web developer, Lori Berkowitz, did a fantastic job with the website, and it's pretty easy to navigate. And we encourage anyone and everyone who goes over there to always contact us. There's a contact form on there. Give us your thoughts, input, because we are still very new and trying to develop our website with everybody's thoughts in mind. So we encourage any input from everyone who wants to drop us a line.
Well, I can tell you that parents are very appreciative, that women are on the spectrum are very appreciative, and, you know, you're doing a great thing. So, you know, thank you very much for what you do, and thank you for being my guest.
Thank you, Marianne. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too.
Bye.
I did want to mention that tomorrow is Rare Disease, International Rare Disease Day, and we will be doing a last-minute change. We're going to have Barb Dietrich, who is the founder of Snap-in Ministries, who is going to come on and discuss rare diseases. Her son has hemophilia. And, you know, we're definitely going to raise some awareness. So that'll be tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock on the chat, and that will be hosted by Elise. Coming up, we also have next Wednesday, we have Dennis DeBout coming on, and he is the leading global voice on autism training for law enforcement and emergency responders. So, you know, I know a lot of parents have asked about, you know, how police officers and firemen and, you know, hospitals know how to deal with children on the spectrum, and now you're going to find out from the man who's teaching them. So that's Wednesday night here on Blog Talk. And next Sunday, he's back. Dr. Carl Picard is coming back, and he has written so many children's book, Why Good Kids Act Cruel, Stop the Screaming, The Connected Father. I mean, he's written, I think, almost 24 parenting books. And he will be back to discuss his new book, Boomerang, and that is next Sunday. So I thank you for joining us as I end the show every time. You are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. The Coffee Clutch.